This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We continue our occasional series on the timber and forest products industry in West Virginia. Today with independent producer Gene Snitiger. In the story, Snitiger takes a look at the history of West Virginia's forests, dating back to before the start of the timber industry in the state.
Just as we came to the hills, we met with a sycamore of a most extraordinary size. It measuring 3 feet from the ground, 45 feet around, lacking 2 inches, and not 50 yards from it was another, 31 feet around. George Washington, written while exploring the Great Kanawha River, November 4th, 1770.
Washington's description of the virgin forest that covered most of West Virginia is one of the few early written accounts we have. We do know that the trees were huge and that the vast forest canopy was often unbroken, making it dark underneath. But there were exceptions. Native Americans used fires to make clearings for agriculture. And in the late 1700s and early 1800s, European settlers built iron ore smelters or furnaces in the forest, according to Joe McNeil, professor of forestry at West Virginia University.
They needed iron to make things that would be durable, tools and weapons, and iron was a valuable commodity. And so they would go out and they would find iron nuggets or iron ore deposits, and they would dig trenches to acquire the iron ore. And then they'd have to smelt it. And so they would build these large iron ore smelters, and they would use coal, but they also used a lot of wood. And so over a long period of time, you had them cutting the trees down to serve as fuel for the smelters.
I've come to the Stewart Recreation Area outside Elkins, part of the Monongahela National Forest. This woodland was last logged more than 100 years ago. I'm with Don Teeter, a surveyor and local historian.
This tree's a red oak, very impressive size. I'm going to stretch the diameter tape around it. We have a diameter of almost 44 inches on this tree. Now, the diameter is measured, generally speaking, 4.5 feet from the ground. It's called DBH, or diameter at breast height, and that's the standard measurement that's used in the timber industry. This is the sort of tree that would excite a logger.
Within a relatively short walk through the woodland, we see large specimens of red oak, black oak, white oak, scarlet oak, chestnut oak, eastern hemlock, yellow poplar, beech, red maple, and black cherry. But Teeter reminded me that before the period of major industrialization in the United States, most of the timber in West Virginia was relatively worthless, except to build your house or a barn or a fence.
When the early settlers first got to this area, the forest was actually an impediment to them, because there was no market for the logs. The trees would keep the ground from being able to produce the grass that they needed to raise livestock. It would keep the sun from being able to reach the ground for them to grow crops. So what they did a lot of times was what was called hacking or deadening, where they would girdle the trees. They would cut through the bark on a strip and maybe 4 to 8 inches wide near the stump of the tree so that the tree would die. And then, of course, once the tree died and you didn't have the thick foliage up there, the sun could make it down through. And gradually over the years, then they would clear the stumps out of the fields.
But the beginning of an intense period of industrialization in the United States meant that West Virginia's ancient forest was about to disappear. Joe McNeil again.
Prior to the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th, we saw this huge swath of the Appalachian forest cut down. And places like Dolly Sods were dramatically affected. I mean, their entire ecology was affected by the harvesting and then the aftermath of burning and reburning and then reburning again.
Between 1879 and 1920, there was a great logging boom. During this period, devastating logging practices and fires removed almost all of the old-growth forest in West Virginia. 30 billion board feet of timber was cut down. Don Teeter says that in the early days, logging was mostly done along rivers, so companies could float the logs to sawmills.
But the real decimation, you could say, of the forest in a lot of areas could not occur until we had the logging railroads, when you could punch those railroads up into all the little hollows and you could reach all of the trees. And the Shea-geared locomotive, the Heisler and the Climax locomotives were critical in that, because they could be used on a grade that was much steeper than other railroad engines could use, and you could have also sharper curves. It was like an all-wheel drive vehicle today. But tremendous power in those engines and the ability to remove large loads from the woods.
But cutting down that much forest in a relatively short time had some pretty horrific consequences. Fires burned large areas, including logging boom towns. After the surrounding forest was cut down, many of those towns disappeared altogether. In addition, there was devastating soil erosion, flooding, and degraded water quality. So in 1911, Congress passed the Weeks Act, which led to the establishment of many eastern national forests, including the Monongahela National Forest, which today covers more than 900,000 acres across 10 counties in West Virginia. Soon after, professional foresters started managing forests to protect wildlife and waterways and to try to maximize the many assets of the forest. Over the next few decades, the forests across West Virginia began to recover. Today, West Virginia boasts 12 million acres of forest, much of which is harvested on a regular basis. Forestry professor Joe McNeil again.
When somebody cuts a stand of timber down, it's not gone forever. If you leave a field just sitting, over time, it becomes a forest again. We've had a variety of harvests across the state, and yet right now there's a huge amount of timberland that exists in the state. Almost 80% of our state, in terms of area, is forested. We've not cut like we used to. So don't be terrified when you see somebody cutting timber down. Go find out what you can about it. I think the other thing I would say is that our forests are renewable. They do come back, sometimes even when you don't want them to. So that would be what I would leave you with.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jean Snediger.
The series is made possible with funding from the Miles Family Foundation. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Areas of fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny with highs in the 70s. Clear skies tonight, low temperatures in the 50s. Mostly sunny on Friday with highs in the 70s. And mostly sunny on Saturday. There's a slight chance of rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 70s and low 80s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. And by the CAMC Foundation, supporting technological advances at CAMC through the purchase of medical equipment like 3D mammography at the Breast Center and the new CT scanner at the CAMC General Hospital. Learn more at camcfoundation.org. Bill Withers, Brad Paisley, Tim O'Brien. These are just a few of the music superstars who hail from the Mountain State. But there's plenty more talent hidden within West Virginia's hills and hollers. And that's what our own Joni Deutsch, a host of A Change of Tune, intends to highlight. Today marks the start of A Change of Tune's 30 Days of West Virginia Music series, where Joni speaks with 30 individuals who help make our state's music scene wild and wonderful. That includes Adam Meisterhans, a native of Wood County who now splits his time producing records in Nashville and touring the world with the Martinsburg, West Virginia band, Roswell Kid.
How was it when you first moved down to Nashville as a West Virginian? Was it a bit of a culture shock musically and life-wise?
It wasn't a culture shock. It's just hard to move anywhere, you know. I had never lived in a city. You know, I went from Washington Bottom, West Virginia, to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which, you know, is about pretty similar in terms of, like, number of people. So, you know, it was the first time I lived in a city. I didn't have any money. I didn't know that many people. So there were a lot of ways in which it sucked. And then there were also a lot of ways where it was incredibly exciting, because I was around, world-class musicians for free there. You know, just whatever you want to tip them, essentially, which is crazy. You know, you can go see Kenny Vaughn play for $3, and he's obviously should get more than $3, but that was what I had at the time. So, like, but you can go experience people playing at a level that I had never really encountered before. And so it's a mix of, like, the normal things that are hard about moving to a new place, countered with an incredibly inspiring experience of being around people that could do things that I had never seen before. So, you know, as a guitar player, as a musician, it sharpens you and it makes you want to go home and practice, and it makes you want to try and just better yourself in whatever way you can. So it was a combination of things. You know, I didn't have a job for a while when I lived there, and the job I did have eventually was substitute teaching, which was trying. So it was hard, but I mean, moving anywhere is hard, and it gets easier, and you get to know more people, get more ingratiated into the scene, I suppose. So yeah.
When you moved down to Nashville, it seems like you were able to focus more on your producing work, right? Or being more part of different bands. Like, it looks like just in the last year, you're working with Coco Hames. And then, of course, Tyler Childers got in the studio with you down there for a bit to, you know, look into a new release. So it seems like you still have been able to balance this, you know, Nashville kind of life where you're focusing on musicians that aren't really necessarily from Appalachia or West Virginia, and then also the musicians that are from the region.
Yeah, when I initially got there, it was just kind of, you know, essentially I knew four people. And of those four people, three of them called me to play guitar at some point in the first year I was there. And then the other person I knew was my roommate, Justin Francis, who, you know, we've become extremely close. But in addition to that, he's an amazing engineer. And so he and I have kind of gotten to work on projects together. So yeah, it's worked out quite nicely, because from all the time I spent playing with the Demon Beat and traveling around, we knew a bunch of people in this region. And then moving down there, I played with J.P. Harris for a while. I played in Joey Plunkett's band for a while. I was kind of able to just be around a lot of different people. And if you're around different people and you're not a total jerk, then eventually maybe, you know, they'll call you to work on something. And yeah, I mean, it's honestly, I just kind of feel lucky to be a part of, you know, anytime somebody calls me, I appreciate it, you know. And so, like, working on Coco Hames's record, she was in a band called The Etts. The bass player from The Etts was Jim Cohen. He got a hold of me to play guitar on her record, and that really meant a lot. And it was playing with Julian Dorio, who's played drums in The Wigs and played drums in Eagles of Death Metal for a while. The bass player is Jack Lawrence, who played in The Greenhorns. He's played in The Raconteurs. Like, you know, playing with people who I admired and who are great musicians, that was a rewarding experience, you know. And then for Tyler to come down and make a record, that was a fun experience. And it's nice to make records with people that you care about, with people who you admire. It's really nice to be a part of those kinds of situations, you know.
To hear the rest of that interview between Adam Meisterhans and Joni Deutsch, as well as Change of a Tune's month-long West Virginia Music Series, go to wvpublic.org/wvmusic. Support for 30 Days of West Virginia Music is provided by Kinship Goods, proud supporter of DIY music and the arts, shipped worldwide at kinshipgoods.com. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, Marshall University, Shepherd University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. I'm Teresa Wills.